It's Rake the Moon, episode 16. With Accrington anxiety, angst, and two tricky fixtures left, the Moonraker takes a long swig from its hip flask and faces up to the last 2 weeks of the regular season. Should access to social media for stressed out players and staff come with the kind of corrosive hazard warning you only tend to see on chemical transport lorries? Reading the comments may have become a problem. And Aaron Drinan, Golden Boot League 2 player of the season, from out of contract to out on the town collecting awards, some thoughts and reflections on this campaign. All coming up in Rake the Moon. But first, the banter section. I was quite interested to see some slightly tetchy comments from Accrington Stanley fans claiming that Swindon had not paid them enough respect. Yet, there was also no reference to the infamous advert involving Accrington. I'm not even going to mention the product because to get to the official banter here, that I think is the most annoying thing that people can do in football and still find funny, to reference that, because it's Accrington have been in the Football League 20 years now and they're annoyingly good against Swindon from our perspective. So are there any things like that, Sam, that other people seem to still find amusing that you would just happily fire into the sun?
I guess slightly related is being told that I'm paid to watch football, I think. And I know that that's slightly adjacent to what you're talking about, but it will never stop annoying me. And I have it from family members and friends and strangers all the time. And I have done throughout my career. And because technically it's true, I guess, it sort of can't be dismissed out of hand. But the idea that you just rock up, sit and watch a game, go home, and you get paid for it is pretty far away from what the reality of the job is. So it's not quite the same, I guess, but that was the immediate thought that came to mind there.
Well, that's what we're here for, to bubble up and let these things out. You do have to attend early, write blogs, speak to people, do stuff, wander the streets, and all that, as well as play the extra games. Well, I'm glad I've got the Accrington thing off my chest. There'll be other ones that I'm sure will spring to mind probably halfway through. So I may mention them, I may not. We'll have to see. Well, I've just been musing before we started this recording. How on earth do we start this? I guess the bare facts are Swindon 2, Accrington 2, Accrington scoring in the first minute and the last minute. Apparently that was the fastest goal, I think, in League 2 this season that they scored, if my reading of these statistics is correct, coming in at 20 seconds. But Swindon almost there, almost with two extra points that we think pretty much would have had them kicking up their heels for the last couple of fixtures in terms of knowing they were at least in the playoffs and just giving Cambridge still a little something to worry about. But it was not to be. So lots of people pretty distraught at the performance, the manager not least of them, I think. But what was your sense of it all, Sam, seeing it unfold in the sunshine in real time?
Yeah, it felt that blow at the end. It felt like someone had just dropped a piano on your head collectively, didn't it? The sudden silence, complete silence, apart from 50 people up in the corner having the time of their lives. And then immediately followed by the clunk of hundreds and hundreds of seats all going up as people walked out. It was all very, very sad and felt so desperately unnecessary, because contrary to what a lot of people seem to be thinking, and maybe I was watching a different game, I thought between minutes 10 and 60 to 70, it was fine. It was obviously not high quality, but this league is not high quality. They got themselves back, as so often they do, from being behind. They were not under immense threat, although they were relinquishing a fair amount of possession. And then the changes that were either enforced, or the movement of personnel, which was decided upon in the moment, created this great big chasm in the middle of midfield. And then they just sat back and back and back and back. And they're not a team that's built to do that. They're a team that Holloway has said is built to chase. they're built to be a peloton, you know, not the breakaway rider. And in this particular instance, it showed really quite clearly why they should not do that. And it was just so, so sad. I don't know about you, Andrew. Other people have had some other thoughts about how good or not so good they were between minutes 10 and 60. But I didn't think it was as bad as it was being made out in places. But it certainly all fell apart around the time when the substitutions started being made. And I think that's probably where the key part of the analysis of this game has to fall.
Yeah, I suppose I think it was okay, that factor of Accrington seemingly getting large amounts of the ball, and without wishing to throw too many stats in, apparently this was the game where Accrington completed the most passes they have in any game this season, which perhaps doesn't come as a great surprise. But that perhaps inability to win the ball back off them felt maybe like it was arriving a bit earlier, and then the subs don't have the impact requested, and the subs are more about, I think, stopping various players seizing up completely than particular plans of trying to keep control of the game. So I think Swindon tried to sort of go out fast, although they obviously started in exactly the opposite way, but were 2-1 up midway through the first half, and then they still had the advantage, but by goodness, they needed that third, isn't it? I suppose the only thing which is slightly weird about it is you'd say they created more, they clearly created more clear chances than Accrington. I think it's difficult to remember what they did other than have those moves that led to the two goals. I can think of one Josh Wood shot from outside the box.
I think there was one header that Conor Ripley saved at the near post.
Oh yes, yeah.
From
the first half corner. You're right. Yeah,
yeah. Those were the two main chances. But of course, you know, Swindon had 2 1-on-1s, and Joe Snowden hits the crossbar between 2-1 and 2-2. That is in itself an example of where things can hinge on such fine margins, and it's just taking into account this game, the Bromley game, the Crawley game, and those 5 points, and how different those 5 points would be. Of course, we could also point to other examples like Tranmere and Shrewsbury and Tranmere again about where it goes in the other direction. So it's probably more evened itself out in the end, but it's still hard not to fixate on the points that got away and the circumstances in which they got away as well. And this is certainly a very difficult one to take. I think that they do need to have a look at what they left themselves with, knowing that they had to manage minutes. So if they know in advance that Tom Wilson-Brown is, well, they were saying he could only play 30 to 45 minutes, and he managed more than that, but still couldn't do 90. And if they're still managing Ollie Clark, and they, you know, I imagine if it was only run by medical people that Ollie Clark would only have played a half on Saturday. But if you know that you're managing that, you would think there might be a slightly better option to leave yourself with than either having to shift Clark back out of midfield for a bit of time to cover for Wilson Brown, or to bring your left wing back into a position which he's already shown he's nowhere near as comfortable in at left centre half. Put a player who doesn't play wing back at wing back, and not have two defenders on the bench in Will Wright or Billy Kirkman, and not have a sort of nibbly midfielder or sort of midfielder in Tom Nicholls available either. And I think in the case of stacking the bench to chase the game, what they've ended up with is not enough options to defend a lead. And hopefully there will be some recognition of that for the next two matches, because a draw, excuse me, a draw in each of these two games is good enough for playoffs. And that might mean having to be a little bit more defensive. Whether or not anyone out there feels that Swindon could do that, I'm not sure. But I think that if they look really hard at how they set themselves up and what they gave themselves to finish the game, they might recognise that they left themselves short there.
Mm, yeah, no, I'm inclined to agree that you might have put one of Wright or Kirkman on there, and hopefully that isn't hindsight, knowing that the players were limited on minutes in advance. This whole issue of kind of substitutes is one of those sort of drumbeats of the discourse we're going to go on into the next part. I do think, to be fair, more of it does come down to, I don't necessarily just mean at the weekend, that trying to juggle people going back with injuries or carrying injuries to some extent. But the manager seems to get a certain amount of stick for his subs. So what's your thought?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, in this particular instance, he can, as I've said there, he could probably be criticised justly for the choices that were made. But in other games, he's been criticised for the starting 11s that he's put together. And often there have been the relevant changes to ensure that points are delivered. And we know that they've scored more goals after 75 minutes than any other team in the division during his tenure. And they've been winning points from losing positions. And that comes as a result of the changes that he's made. But at the same time, on Saturday, there obviously was an issue with the substitutions. I think there is a general movement towards this idea of finishers and starters. And I don't discount it out of hand. I understand what the concept is. But I think that if you're going to do that, you probably need to have more defined roles for a lot of your players as to whether they're finishers or whether they're starters. I think in the example of Fletcher Holman, there is quite a good case for him being used as a finisher. You know, he has had so much more impact off the bench than he's had when he started, for various different reasons. But what Holloway has done quite a lot this season is mix up those roles so that some people are sometimes their starters, sometimes their finishers. And perhaps that can lead to either a perception of a disjointed approach or an actual disjointed approach on occasion. And maybe using those roles in a more defined way might give a little bit more consistency. I certainly think that football fans typically want to see a certain team that's doing well stay together, because that's how most of us were brought up in football. Most of us watched football at an age when it was three subs or fewer when we were growing up. Increasingly now, the new generations don't watch it like that, so they'll consume it a slightly different way. But what I'm interested to see is whether Holloway has applied this approach at previous clubs, and I'm not sure. You know, it's only Grimsby 4 years ago, 5 years ago, that would be the last example. But whether this is something that he's tried to bring into his game during his time at Swindon, or whether it's something that he had steadily evolved to over time, I'm not sure. I can understand why it leaves an element of disconnect with supporters. But at the same time, I think that people have been very quick to criticise his starting 11s, then they're quick to criticise his substitutes. And at the same time, they've managed to scrape out 75 points from this season. So it's hard, isn't it, to find a balance of fairness in here. And sometimes that struggle is a little bit too much.
I think the chance for him to work with the five subs rule must be fairly new, because I think that only came in for COVID, didn't it, when he was at Grimsby. So this is probably his first real taste of it. I'm speaking off the top of my head here, so I could check back, of having that number of options to kind of get things going from the bench. It always seemed to be a great Neil Warnock thing as well, didn't it? How many strikers can we sign and fit into a 11? So you know, clearly there is some recognition for do that. Let's try and put Accrington behind us. I think the other thing that is causing sweaty palms and various other elements of the human anatomy not to function as they should, the nature of the last two games away at Grimsby and Chesterfield, who are bang in playoff contention if putting together mixed results, not least when playing each other.
Yeah, and it's understandable why people get nervous over that. It is a very strange scenario where the team are 3 points off the top three and 4 points ahead of eighth, and still the natural urge is to look over your shoulder rather than look above. And I think probably that's just been the conditioning of everybody to do with the club since January, where the expectation of the bad times has surpassed the hope for and or anticipation of the good, and it's left everyone being just really quite nervous. We'll come on to Aaron Drynan in a bit, but even when he was picking up his awards last night, he sort of mentioned how they're sort of hanging on, but they'll stay in there till the end. And he said it's been a bit touch and go recently. And so you sort of get the impression that it's on their minds at the moment. And that will feed into the overall sense of, oh no, oh no. But we have to remember that a point in each game or one win over the two will definitely be enough. And I think my maths is right here, I think if Barnet don't win their remaining three and Cambridge beat Grimsby, then just a point at Grimsby will be enough. So there is not too much to be concerned about, but I know why the fan base is feeling the way it does. What about you, Andrew? What do you feel? Are you worried or are you fairly calm?
I think I'm slightly worried, though. It's a very bizarre position, isn't it? Where were Grimsby to win against Cambridge in this game in hand on Tuesday at the Abbey Stadium? In theory, that might open up some vague hope of automatic promotion again, but I think Cambridge have got to play Barrow at the weekend, so let us not dwell on that too much. I think just kind of looking at sort of points totals and, you know, the sort of fairly basic analytic stuff, it's just the drop off since January is kind of quite clear and quite stark. I think that's what gives me a little bit of anxiety. You know, the numbers of shots they've had in particular have kind of dropped off. They're still doing reasonably well with kind of quality of chances. So it's, you know, if you think a Ian Holloway side is designed to kind of run and press and drive forward in the way they did quite well at times in some parts of that Accrington game, I suppose I worry a little bit they're not showing the characteristics of what the manager likes his teams to do. And yeah, the fact it does feel down to a matter of mind as much as ability now, and everyone's clearly feeling it, is making me a bit anxious. Yeah, I'm tiptoeing into Grimsby on Saturday lunchtime with a bit of nerves, I must admit. I may have them, but the players, of course, they can have them, but they must know how to control them. And I think that those last minutes at Accrington against Accrington felt a bit like we're just trying to will this to happen, and we're not quite sure how we're going to make it happen.
Yeah, I think there's been a bit of a slip from everybody who was challenging for the top three over the last six games. Because if we look at the last six game form table, to find the first team, so there's Chesterfield currently in third place in that six game form table, and Salford is seventh, Cambridge are eighth. Both Bromley and MK Dons sit below Swindon in that six game form table. It's been a collective issue recently. Of course, you can stretch it over to January as well, and there's obviously been an issue at the club since January, related initially, I think, as we all know, to the combination of the Luton game and the loss of Finlay Munro. But there are other clubs that are feeling the same way, and Notts County at the moment are incredibly inconsistent. I think there's not as much of a difference between Swindon Town and a lot of these other teams in the way they have experienced the last couple of months. And I think it's just the nature of, but it was there for the taking and it's gone again, that is causing everybody to feel the way they do. I'm still very confident of a playoff finish. It would take an awful lot for both of those teams, or for Barnet to overtake. I know why people are worrying, but until it's gone, it's still there. So let's try and keep it a little bit upbeat, a little bit positive. I mean, the worst thing that can happen is that the fan base it turns on the team if they need a point against Chesterfield and they go behind early. And the way that things are at the moment, it feels so combustible that something like that could easily happen. So I think if people want to have the enjoyment of a playoff campaign, maybe even a trip to Wembley and the chance at promotion, then there's got to be a sense of an attempted enjoyment of what comes. I think my feeling at the moment is there's probably quite a few fans that don't actually want that they worry about what would happen next if Swindon did get promoted, and that then they feel disconnected, and therefore it's not quite what it should be when you're challenging for promotion. But I guess that's the nature of how the club and the fan base have had their relationship for the past few years, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I think rationally 75 points is almost always enough. I guess the other thing that strikes to mind is you can imagine what they're saying at Notts County. We were in such a good position, then we got stuffed at Cambridge, we lost in the playoffs last year, and Alassane Jatta lost his head, got sent off, we lost to Wimbledon, who aren't actually that good and managed to go up. So maybe everyone else is having their psychodrama as well, that we certainly are. But no, I still take calm, deep breaths and think they'll find the point at least they need. But it's going to be interesting finding out. And you can probably tell by my breathing patterns that I have to reassure myself about it all. Now, for our next section, we're probably going to be back on the social media beat to some extent. But I do feel before we get stuck into this, I should lay a preface in that I generally think when players post stuff on social media, if you go and look at the replies, despite what people think, so many are kind of positive and supportive usually, and sometimes they're wise enough not to post when things have not gone according to plan. So I did want to make that caveat there first, but it does feel like some of Swindon have been reading the comments in parlance. So this generally tends to be the advice sometimes you get given when you post an article, kind of don't read the comments in terms of they can go off in wild and sometimes remarkably toxic directions. And everyone is on edge, everyone is stressed out, Sam, but clearly some of that stuff I think has been getting through.
Yeah, and I think that it's, you always, sage advice is not to go online and not to go on social media and not to read comments if you're the subject of the article, or if you're, you know, part of the team that the article is referring to, or podcast or the tweet or whatever. And it's always good advice, but in practical terms, it's almost impossible for a lot of people to actually uphold. And I think particularly the manager has been looking at stuff recently, and evidently that's caused him to then make mention of it in public in the press conference. And I think that generally that doesn't then get the desired effect. It doesn't usually have the context that's required around it to explain the details of how it's impacting, why it's impacting. There is a conversation here, it's not unique to Swindon, about how people choose to use social media, and there's a difference between disappointment, critical examination, constructive criticism, just at least expressing an opinion in a coherent and at least vaguely polite manner. And there's the route that a group of people choose to take, which is obscene and vulgar and aggressive and quite personal. And the line between those two things has always been particularly blurred by social media. I think there's always been an element in stadiums where people have felt like they can give what they want for no consequence. And part of that still remains within football culture, and part of that is an accepted part of going to the ground. I think sometimes it is also unnecessary. Some of the more personal and abusive comments I think there's two distinctions here. One is that these footballers, managers, coaches, etc., are human, and they also generally can't retaliate particularly. They can't give it back. We saw a great example of that just at Colchester, where Holloway gave it back but was immediately sent off. It's very difficult to exist in this environment in which criticism is allowed to be abusive, aggressive, insulting in one direction, and in the other direction it is policed a lot more strictly. And I think that collectively as football fans, while emotion is a massive part of this game, there are ways in which to express emotion that don't have the sort of impact that some of these comments online can, because yes, they're just words, but you know, hurty words are still hurty words. They still can have a real impact on a human being. So there is that part of it. The other part, which I think people forget all the time, is that the men and women who hold the controls of the social media accounts of football clubs and other sports institutions do not have an iota of impact on the overall result. And when you look through the replies to Saturday's final score tweet from the club, and you see the amount of obscenity and vulgarity and abusiveness and just callousness and heartlessness and spite that comes out, and you know who people are receiving that on the other end, and you know that they can't do anything about it, and yet they've got to read all of your bile for hours upon hours, just endless notifications of hate coming in. You just got to think of how that impacts on these people as individuals. And it's just so needless. And yes, you're frustrated. Everyone understands that you can be frustrated. Everyone is entitled to voicing that frustration, but you're not entitled to having such a negative impact on another person who couldn't do anything about it. So I obviously feel strongly about this, because I'm sure that you've experienced it, Andrew, too. Being part of the media means that you too are occasionally a direct recipient of this sort of stuff, because you can be seen as an easy target, or it can be seen as being fair game to target you because maybe you've got more of a public profile. It's not fair game. Just find a way of voicing your frustration and your criticism that doesn't have to get abusive, vulgar, personal, and hateful. And if we could just do that, it might be easier to create an environment in which we could enjoy things together, because increasingly it becomes harder to do that when the public voice of the fans is becoming just a little bit more and more ugly.
No, I have to say I'm very lucky with my social media experience. I find that people are overwhelmingly good-natured, I would say. Perhaps more than you might care to think, but I think it's true in any walk of life. The one comment with a barb in it can stick with you more easily than the kind of 30 plus ones that are the sort of positive ones or supportive ones or friendly ones. I think the one under, not explored, maybe not recognised things, I can remember going back to my more youthful supporting days. I think I'm sure some of my then opinions, probably less informed opinions on Steve McMahon and his general managership and general tenure, that I might have said to people after slogging it up to whatever part of the north it was for another terrible away performance in March. I think if I'd actually had some of those printed out and put online and read back to me, I'd probably be mortified at this point. So I just wonder whether there's some kind of weird line that is lost between the kind of things you would say to friends you go with that are, you know, almost positively, provocatively outrageous and not entirely serious, even if the kind of broad thrust of the emotion is underneath them, whether the fact they might get posted out in exactly the same way is just a sort of layer of protection for people involved with clubs that they didn't sort of have when, or they had when social media didn't exist and you just had to vent in other ways. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. You know, we're always taught in journalism that don't put on social media something that you wouldn't want to have on the front page of a paper and have to back that up. And I think that is a good way of trying to apply it. And I'm sure some of the comments that get said are not intentionally quite as aggressive as they appear. They might well be said in a more, I say said, might be written in a more jokey tone, but they lose all context amongst a general stream of stuff that's a lot worse. I think it's very easy just to not say something rather than have to become aggressive in these situations.
Or stick it in your WhatsApp group.
Perhaps. Or stick it in your WhatsApp group, or moan in the pub. It's not like you or I won't be moaning in very different ways about certain situations at the football club than maybe we say publicly. And that's not being two-faced. That's managing relationships. It's understanding humanity. It's just sort of basic politeness and common courtesy. And there's a gap between the two. And I don't think that necessarily because as fans we buy tickets and we put money into the club, I don't think we're entitled to be abusive. I think that the fans are entitled to be critical, and sometimes that criticism can take a more aggressive form, and in certain contexts that's entirely acceptable part of the game. Sometimes that criticism can be rude but funny, and I think that that's perfectly acceptable part of the game. I think that we forget to police ourselves, and then collectively we forget to police each other about the levels to which we're willing to go when we talk to each other, particularly strangers in an online environment. I'm not sure there's any particular sight of that changing on the horizon, but I wanted to talk about it briefly today. Just if anything that one person thinks, if there's a bad result on Saturday, just for a moment about how they're expressing themselves and their feelings after the game.
So if you've bared with us through this double bill of collective angst so far, we'll try and end on something a little more cheery. The success of Aaron Drynan, his goal against Accrington, number 28 of the season, 22 in the league. I think he's pretty much guaranteed to finish now the League Two Golden Boot. Not only is he the League Two Golden Boot, he is in the League Two Team of the Year, and he is now the League Two Player of the Year following the EFL Awards ceremony at the weekend. Not bad for someone who was spending some of their time last season being injured and wondering quite what the future held for them. Some of which, Sam, is in an article that you have discreetly removed from the paywall, and anyone who wants to go to the Moonraker can take a look at on the Drynaissance, as I've just decided to call it.
Very good. So I wrote a feature on Aaron in February, and I've just updated this, giving a sort of backstory to his last year and where he's come from, which is really remarkable. The change, not in the individual, because I think that the general recognition is that his character has always been the same, but just the way in which he's managed to find this. It's just an incredible run of form. And you would think that a year ago he was training in a field back home in Ireland, trying to get to full fitness and sending video back using his trainer as a tripod to capture him doing the shuttle runs, the Holloway shuttle runs, as proof of his recovery prior to signing that new contract. And he was coming up to being out of contract last year. And from there, and from where he'd previously been peripheral to now being the top player in the division is an incredible rise and testament to a guy who has absolutely applied himself and taken his chance after Harry Smith's injury to become the marksman at Swindon Town. He's evidently well-liked within the changing room. He's well-liked within the fan base, and hopefully whatever level he's playing at with Swindon next year, it will continue with this run of form. But I think it's a lovely story, and no one, I would challenge anyone to predict a year ago that this was going to happen.
I think for the last months of last season, you could see the value of the of what he could do and the kind of impact he could have. But I think we all thought that there was going to be a striker in a central position probably, and he's going to maintain that role out wide and perhaps sort of chip in with goals here and there as he's tended to do in his career, not quite become such a prolific marksman. I think good striker seasons, there are a couple of spectacular goals in there, but most of them feel like, perhaps do feel like this, where a lot of it has been putting away chances in good positions, those ones that you think a striker ought to score, but inevitably they don't score all of. He's done that. I think he's done that pretty well.
I think he has done well. I think there's been a couple of sort of more trademark type goals for him, which is opening up the instep of the right foot either first time or a couple of touches from 15 yards or so. I think the goals that stand out for me, obviously the Shrewsbury one, which was just as much down to his teammates as him, but it's still an excellent finish. Also down to his teammates was the goal at Crewe, but again, it's a fantastic first-time finish. And the one against Barrow to give Swindon the lead late on, he burst down the left-hand side and opens his body up, almost sort of Thierry Henry-esque to put it in the opposite corner. I think there's just been a decisiveness about how he's been in front of goal, which is not something that we'd seen from him before, which is the interesting change. And you look at his XG compared to his goals actually scored, I think his XG is 17, so he's well up on that, and which suggests a striker that really is on top of his game. And to be honest, I think everybody knows that by the fact he's got nearly 30 goals this season. But it's been excellent, and I think there should be credit due to everybody who's worked with him, team and coaches, as to where he's got to. Let's see whether he can sustain it. But it's definitely been among the storylines of Swindon Town season and of the division as a whole.
Yeah, I can't imagine that when the various Player of the Year awards are handed out, there'll be anything other than with a sort of a Irish tricolour placed on them, I would imagine. So he looks set for those. Yeah, it is an interesting question. Can he sustain it? But I think from what you've said there, because I am becoming perhaps a bit too much of a numbers nerd, the fact that he's got in a position to be able to work so many chances, as well as getting some good chances from his colleagues, suggests that, you know, perhaps he can be a consistent goal scorer, and this year won't just be such a one-off. Not necessarily there's going to be another season where he gets close to 30, but somewhere in the 15 to 20 range seems potentially plausible from the kind of stats you work off.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's reasonable. And this isn't like it's his first season where he's shown himself to be a goal scorer. There was that one other season at Leighton Orient where he did it. So the ability is evidently there. I think it just feels as though he's got confidence, where previously it didn't look as though he's got that confidence in front of goal. So let's hope that sustains over 2, 3, 4, 5 more matches. And then doesn't go off for too much of a holiday and comes back in June ready to do it all over again.
It would be nice to think so. It'd be nice to think he's giving Sheffield Wednesday problems at some point in the middle of September. But we, I guess, shall see whether that is going to happen or not. I think that's just about brings us to a conclusion for this week's Rake the Moon. Reminder to visit the Moonraker, where you can check out Sam's article on Aaron Drynan. Subscribe for the appallingly reasonable price of £5 a month or £50 a year to keep in touch with all Sam's reporting on the matters Swindon Town based. And the guaranteed extensive end of season inquest articles for better or worse.